Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, let me grab the headphones. I'll get dialed into the studio. Get these dogs to shut up. Oh, goodness. I better close the window or the neighbors are going to get mad. Hope the guests call in tonight. Wonder if anybody's going to call in. Well, let's do this thing.
It's Rated G Radio, and this is your host, Garrett Miller.
Welcome, everybody, to Rated G Radio. Tonight is Wednesday, and we're going to be having a fantastic author, Darlene Quinn, join us in just a couple of moments to talk about her incredible career and also about her web books, Unpredictable Webs. We've got Webs of Fate, Conflicting Webs, Twisted Webs, Webs of Power, all kinds of webs, and she's going to be talking about that live with us in just a moment. I want to give a big shout-out to last night's guest, John Odlum, who is featured on a Facebook page today called Look for the Good Projects, and he is talking about some of the things that he's grateful for in life, and it's a fairly major essay, so I was excited to see that last night posted after his appearance on the show, and good things are always said about Mr. Odlum, so if you get a chance to take a look at that, that would be really cool. Without further ado, though, I want to welcome Darlene Quinn to the show, and thank you for your first appearance on Rated G Radio. Welcome.
It's my pleasure.
Well, Darlene, you have so many things that I want to talk to you about. I'm not even sure if we could do it in a six-hour program, but I'm going to sure give it a shot in about an hour. So I appreciate you taking your time out of your schedule because I know you've also been busy doing you've been completing another book, which is going to be released next year. But for all of the listeners that are joining us tonight, many who have been reading your books and follow your career, but for those who are not familiar with you, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your history?
Sure. We don't have an hour.
Okay. Well, we'll have the Reader's Digest version, I guess.
Okay. Well, I'm sort of an unlikely author. I have been a storyteller my entire life. However, I grew up in a time when the education system thought it was really cool to teach sight reading instead of phonics. And unfortunately, my greatest creativity came in spelling, which ended up with little red circles all over my papers. They looked like they'd broken out in the measles. So I had never thought of a career as an author. And if you look over my resume, it's very checkerboard. When I was in high school, you sort of go along with your friends, and they were going to be teachers or nurses or secretaries, which was about the limit for women at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to do any of those things. What I wanted to do was be an airline hostess and travel the world. But in order to do that, I had to either have 2 years of college or 2 years of work experience. So I went to college. And in my time, my very best friend had to change her career path. The biology for a nursing career just didn't suit her. So having lots of units to spare, I decided I'd take a class with her. And it was an early teaching class. And I really liked it. So my first real job was as a elementary school teacher. And I loved it. And then I took a course in where I grew up in Long Beach, California. One of the things that girls went to was Wilma Hastings, which was a beauty and fashion charm school kind of thing. But I'd never done that. And so my late husband decided that what he would do was get me a gift certificate for a career kind of class. Self-improvement. And I did that, and then I started doing some modeling, photographic and ramp modeling, which was fun. And then I ended up with my own teaching for the woman that taught these classes. And then I decided to do my own, and I started beauty and fashion classes through Bullock's Department Store in Lakewood. And all of my checkerboard career was never leaving something I wasn't interested in. I just kept finding things I liked better. So as I was doing that, I had two children. I had a son who was 6 and a daughter who was born severely deaf. And we discovered that when she was a year old. And so I had to quit teaching, and I was still doing the beauty and fashion classes. And at that time, I needed to get a job that paid some money. And what I decided to do was I had this beautiful resume. I had the charm classes, the modeling. I had done the Miss Universe pageant, the Long Beach portion, teaching girls how to walk and do that kind of thing. And I did some courses for the underprivileged and was doing those. And then I started doing some classes for hospital groups. And I read an article. This article said that the Ross Luce Medical Group had gone to Continental Airlines to teach their people good grooming skills, self-improvement, public relations, that kind of thing. And I thought, I can do that. Mm-hmm. So I started doing it for some hospital groups. And by that time, my husband and I had separated, and my daughter was going into regular school, which meant that I would no longer get that kind of support. So I needed a job. And with all this beautiful resume, I couldn't type. I had not typed since I was in college for term papers. And at that time, I typed on a manual typewriter.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So it was like, it was out with the dinosaurs. And I needed a job. I had this wonderful resume that looked like I was all dressed up with nowhere to go. And I did something brilliant. I didn't know what was brilliant at the time, but it ended up to be something very brilliant. I had this resume putting all of these things together that I had done. And I even rented an electric typewriter. This was before computers. So I rented an electric typewriter. Had I had to make my living that way, I would have starved. And I went to an employment agency, and they said, well, you were with Bullocks. I was as a private contractor. I did charm classes, beauty and fashion classes, classes for career women, but as a private contractor. So she said, why don't you apply to Bullocks? So I knew if I sent this resume to the personnel department, I'd get a lovely letter saying, gee, that is really great. If something comes out, we'll be sure and get in touch with you. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want that kind of letter.
Right.
So what I did is I called Bullocks, and I wanted to know who was in charge. And I sent my resume to the CEO of Bullock Department Stores.
Oh, my goodness.
And which I would recommend to people. The people down lower levels are busy, a lot busier. If you send to the top of the pile, now that CEO is not going to read your resume and is not going to interview you. But what he does do is he gives it to his personnel person and says, take care of this.
Right.
Which is what happened. And I came in and had a great interview. The person that I interviewed with was head of organization development, and he had just come in from the May company, and what I didn't know was he was heir apparent to senior vice president for the Bullocks department stores.
Oh, my goodness.
Which there were about 26 at the time. And so he said he liked me, and what they wanted to do, I had not one day experience in retail. Not one. Oh, wait a minute. When I was in high school, one Christmas, I worked at the May company.
There you go.
And I didn't like it at all. So I had no experience at all. But what they were interested in the Bullock's department stores is, in terms of their management, all of their people that were on the tracks to become managers, buyers, top executives, were kids on a career path with no management skills. And they would become a manager of a department with these sales associates who had been there since they'd been in diapers. And so we were talking about that, and he was very interested. And he said, "Darlene, don't you dare take a job without calling me." He says, "I've just come in as an outsider, and I'm obligated to interview all the personnel directors and training directors," because this was a head of corporate training for all of the Bullock stores.
Wow.
And so I was very excited, and I had done a couple of other hospitals, and I was going to talk to Memorial, Long Beach Memorial Hospital, but I, you know, it was that period of time that I made a great hourly salary. But when you work 5 hours a week, it kind of doesn't
it doesn't matter.
Well.
Yeah, yeah, it doesn't work out.
So I didn't think that this was going to work, but he had told me not to take a job until I called him. So I thought, okay, I'm going to call him. It had been maybe a couple of weeks. So I just told him that I was going in to talk to the hospital, and he said, "Come in tomorrow morning." He had me come in, hired me before I filled out the application. And then I felt like I fell down the rabbit hole, because I was I went to lunch with all of the executive development department. There were executive trainers, personnel people, all of these people. And I went to lunch with them, and I felt like I did not know the language, AGMOs and the this and the that. And you know, I just felt like, you know, what in the heck have I gotten myself into? But I took their little manual home for their executive trainees, and I looked at those, and that was great. You know, an AGMO is Assistant General Manager of Operations, and, I mean, there was nothing hard. You know, it's like, how do you drive a car?
Mm-hmm.
You know, once you know how to do it, it's easy. So I went in the next day, and I felt like I knew everything. And I was with the train. You know, a lot of times the things that happen to you in life are luck, timing, as long as you're ready for the job. And it was a certain amount of luck that we clicked, and that the training director was moving to Florida with her husband, and which left that opening.
Uh-huh.
So I sat down with the training director, and I knew all of these terms, and there was equal opportunity and all these executive training and everything else. And we're sitting and talking, and she said, "An ETC," and I'm thinking, ETC, executive, and she looked at me, she said, "Et cetera." Oh, I hadn't expected. I thought this was some brave new thing.
Right.
Anyway, I've loved doing everything that I have done in the past, and I'm really enjoying being an author more than anything. I didn't leave jobs because I didn't like them. The reason that I resigned from Bullock's, I was hired as corporate training director for Bullock's Wilshire, and then through a series of very nice things that moved several people, I became head of personnel and organization development for the Bullock's Wilshire stores. And however, my daughter was having some trouble in high school at that time, and my late husband was head of Shell Oil for the West Coast with Hawaii in his territory, but I reported directly to the president of Bullock's Wilshire, and couldn't take the time. You know, in fact, it was horrible if I took 2 weeks together. And we had a lot of opportunities for doing that. I became at Bullock's Wilshire known as the company shrink. And
Now, why did they call you that? I love that.
Well, I reported to the president, so all of the executive people would come to me with problems with the president, with other people, and I even got into personal problems with them. But we would be working through various things, and basically reporting directly to the president, whom we nicknamed the Benevolent Dictator. He was a fabulous person, but he was hell on executives. The salespeople adored him. And he was one of the, I think one of the first people I know that really adopted in management the upside-down pyramid,
mm-hmm.
where the salespeople were the most important people in the organization, which is correct. You know, without the sales, nothing else.
Nothing happened.
There were no special privileges for executives. We didn't have special parking places. We were in the day after Christmas because the sales associates were. We were there on inventory night, even though, you know, we didn't know really what we were doing, but we were there for the moral support. And I think he was right. He was absolutely right in what he was doing. But he was not easy to work with, particularly for the male executives.
Do you think, just going back here, do you think what part of your background do you think gave you either the special touch that people felt comfortable talking to you in such a manner? And to get the title of the psychiatrist or the shrink is, you know, that's quite an honor.
Well, my minor was psychology.
Oh, okay.
So I did. That was when I
that
went
was part
to school.
Of it.
Education was my major, and psychology was my minor. In fact, right now I'm using that because what I always like in books is I want to know why people do what they do.
Oh, very
and
smart.
I have my blogs right now. I have a whole series of blogs on why people do what they do. We've had the psychology of loss, grief, love. I don't know. I'm on my sixth one now. Anger. But I think that's what's important when you have characters in a book. You need to know why they're doing what they're doing. And often,
and whether,
go ahead.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I used to hear authors, like on panels, talking about what their characters wouldn't let them do, and their characters had taken, and I thought, what do you mean? You're writing the book.
Exactly.
So what do you mean your characters take over? Well, they do.
So
once you give them that personality, you give them certain moral compass, a certain personality, and you have a character that maybe you want something to happen, but that mm-hmm. character won't do it.
How interesting. So now, did you start your writing when you were still at Bullock's, or was this after you made your departure from...
No, it was after. I never thought about becoming a writer. When I was corporate training director, we started a newsletter.
Okay.
And it was not until after I resigned from Bullock's Wilshire. I resigned for two reasons. One was my daughter was in high school. She was severely deaf and having a tough time. And my late husband was about a year from retirement. And I wanted to have some time to travel with him, and I was just ready to be retired.
It was time.
But I wasn't.
Yeah, right.
I am totally unsuited for retirement. I found that out very quickly. So there's a lot of things that women would love to do if they didn't have to go to work every day, Now, one of my main goals was to clean my closets.
Okay.
And I did that. But I don't like repetition a whole lot.
Sure.
You know, after I got that, and I was playing tennis, but I needed something more. So I looked into doing some writing on the things that I knew about, because I'd never been a writer. And that was, at that time, is right when the personal computers were going up. In the mid to 80s. And my daughter, her father had given her an Apple, one of the very first Apples.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
It did not have a hard drive. It only had one floppy drive. And with one floppy drive, you couldn't add anything. It would stop every time I had WordPerfect. It would stop every time I came to my name, my street address, with a spell check. So it was a challenge. But I did some articles for Savvy Magazine and some professional journals on things like interviewing skills, negotiating skills, time management, and various things, which were what I was involved in when I was head of personnel and organization development for the Wilshire stores and also for the Bullock stores.
Okay.
And so I was...
Oh, perfect. Go ahead.
So when I was doing those, and it was an arduous task because, as I told you, my greatest creativity is in spelling. And it's really not greatly admired. So I decided that I'd also take a writing class. You know, right now I have 5 dictionaries on my computer. I'm much better at spelling than I was when I started.
I would hope so.
But I decided to take a writing class out at Long Beach City College, a creative writing class. And that's where, and it was just basically the nonfiction things that I was doing from my own background. But this creative writing class came up when one of the assignments was to write a poem. Well, I don't write poems. I thought, you know, that's just something I don't do. But I am also somewhat compulsive when it comes to an assignment. So I sat in the parking lot at the school and wrote this sort of non-rhyming poem about my teenager that wasn't coming home at night. And my father, who thought everything I did was wonderful, sent it in to this poetry contest, and I won being in this anthology, and with it came a correspondence course to either nonfiction or fiction. And so I thought, well, I'll take the fiction. And then I kept coming up to things I had no idea how to do. You know, write this in 3 different viewpoints. I thought, I don't know how to do that. But when it was due, I did it. And then fiction is so much fun. So that kind of got me hooked.
That got you hooked. I love that story because you have so many different things that you've done. You've done, you know, you've been a teacher. You've worked with beauty pageants. You've worked in corporate America. You have helped hospitals. You've done all of this, and now you find yourself getting hooked writing for the fun of writing. And then, so when you decided that you said, you know what, this is something that I kind of like to do, when did you say, you know what, I think I'm going to sit down and write a book, or was it even something conscious that you did?
No, well, after I took this class, then I took a workshop on novel writing, and I decided I wanted to write. And by then, they had hard drives and things. Which made it a little bit easier, and that I could put my spelling things on there. And I started out, and I knew nothing about even how to get a character. You know, I'd written only nonfiction. You know, when negotiating skills, you don't need a lot of dialogue for your characters. and you don't need to get them into a room and into a chair, none of which I knew how to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I started having fun with it, and I took a novel class from, well, I took two of them, one at Long Beach City College, and the fellow that taught that class has his poetry books in all over universities, and he was up for the Pulitzer Prize.
Oh, my goodness.
And he was a great help. And at first he was saying, Darlene, you're memo writing. You know, it was more like memos instead mm-hmm. of real conversations. And he gave me one hint that I am on the staff of the Southern California Writers Conference and have taught a lot of classes on writing, and I give this suggestion to writers. Write, at least read what you've written in first person, even whether you're going to write in first person or not, because there's certain language when you put an I in front of it that will not come out.
Oh.
It makes it much more natural. When you're sticking it out of somebody else's mouth, you can get to literary. So that was a huge help to me.
That was and I apologize. I want to ask if you would go back. Do you have a copy of the poem that your father submitted that won the contest for you?
Well, Garrett, I was going to tell you I didn't have it because I didn't think I did. And then you had said something about it, so I thought, oh, well, I'll go just look and make sure I don't have it. And my father kept the anthology book, and I did find it. And
would you share that with us tonight?
That was just tonight. No,
oh
actually,
gosh.
It was earlier today. It was this morning.
Okay.
So did you want to hear this?
I would love it if you would share that with everybody tonight. Yes, please.
Okay. It's called, and I'm not a poetry writer, but it's called Life with a British Teenager. It's been nearly 3 years since we had her a part of our lives. In reflection, I wonder, could we have predicted the changes she'd made in our lives? After all, she was 11 years old. Obviously, she'd had a past history. Ours was not her first home, perhaps not even her second. I must admit I had some reservations. But she was English, beautiful, and very appealing. For my English husband, it was love at first glance. Therefore, we joyously and proudly brought her home. That was May 5th, 1984. Our home hasn't been the same since. From the very beginning, she refused to come home each night. She'd be gone for a day, a night, a week, and at times longer. My husband continues to rationalize her behavior. We now realize she is a teenager and probably won't change. We are the ones that must adjust. When I share my thoughts and frustrations with family and friends, their eyes twinkle, a smile emerges, and a chuckle emerges. That sounds strange. Well, what do you expect? She's merely living up to her reputation, a true 1973 Jaguar.
Oh. That is great.
We had bought this 73 Jaguar, and
mm-hmm.
and she spent more time in repair than with us.
Thank
so that was my
that.
Brilliant poem that launched me into a writing career.
Thank you. That was a special treat. I appreciate that very much. So let's start talking about your books, the web series of books, because I want listeners to hear about that. And, of course, on the show page tonight, there's a bunch of links. We've tried to make it easy for you. So if you want to check out Darlene's website, you can click and do that. You can follow Darlene on Twitter by clicking that link. You can read Darlene's blog by clicking that link, of course. And there's two books that I have linked up for you to go to Amazon. It's Webs of Fate and Unpredictable Webs, two of your books that you have in your series here. What was the first book in the series that you chose to write?
Actually, the first book in the series is the third one that was published. Now,
how did that happen?
A little bit. Well, the first book that I published was Webs of Power.
Okay.
Webs of Power, and how I really got started in this is the back, I write faction. I write page-turning suspense based on real events in the world of department stores, the fashion industry. The backgrounds of my books are absolutely authentic. However, I never let the facts get in the way of page-turning suspense.
Sure.
So the first book that I actually wrote, I worked with the movers and shakers in the retail industry. And basically my main male movers and shakers in the industry, and actually some of the women too, their careers really follow the real people. Their personal lives are pure fiction.
Okay.
And totally pure fiction. And for, I worked with the man, Alan Questrom, who was CEO of Bullock's, and I worked with him. And, well, I'll go on to the books themselves, because both Alan Questrom, who was CEO of Bullock's, went on, when he would not work for the man that took them over, went on to become CEO of Neiman Marcus.
Oh, wow.
Was pulled back into Bullock's, to Federated, to take them out of bankruptcy. His career then led him to take over Macy's, the Broadway Emporium stores. And then the other man that I worked with, who was two off doors down from me when I was corporate training director, is Terry Lundgren. And he is now CEO of Macy's, Inc. And
goodness.
Both of those men I went to meet with before. And Terry continues to be a terrific source because I want my backgrounds authentic. However, I have found out when I started writing fiction that fiction has limitations because fiction must be believable. The truth does not have to be. Therefore, my first book, Webs of Power, the background of that book is the takeover of the Federated department stores and the selling off of the West Coast, Bullock's, Bullock's, Wilshire, and I. Magnin's to Macy's. My corporate raider, since he had to be believable, I had to tone him down. Instead of a Canadian, I made him an Australian.
Okay.
Now, my corporate raider has had two nervous breakdowns, liposuction, mm-hmm. a facelift, mm-hmm. a hair transplant. He fills his pool with mineral water. But I have to make him believable, so I didn't give my character a wife and family in one city and a mistress and family in another. All true of Robert Campo, a Canadian, who had taken over the Allied stores, which were Brooks Brothers, Ann Taylor, Bonwit Teller. He was already driving those stores into bankruptcy.
Mm.
They're called Amalgamated in my book. And he fell in love with Bloomingdale's. And he went after all of Federated, could not afford the whole of Federated, so he sold off the West Coast to Macy's, Bullock's, Bullock's, Wilshire, and I. Magnin's. The background, you would know exactly how Macy's got the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
However, that's not the story. That is, I'm not really into World War II, but there's a lot of novels that I really like that are set in World War II.
Okay.
So you don't really have to care about the fashion industry or the department stores. It's the background.
Sure.
They happen to fascinate me. They don't fascinate everyone. The Webs of Power are three dynamic women whose worlds are turned upside down with this takeover. And the men are the ones that are making a lot of this happen. And they basically follow the lives of the real men that were making these things happen. But it's filled with drama and intrigue. And then some people ask why I just started to write a series. I did not make that decision. I thought when I first decided I was going to write a novel, I thought that's pretty awesome. I wasn't even sure I could do it. And some people along the way said, are you going to do a series? And I thought, how could I do that? How could I have these characters have that many different things to do?
Uh-huh.
Well, who made the decision were my characters themselves.
Uh-huh.
They just have not finished. They're still going. So my next book, Twisted Webs, at that point, one of my main characters delivers twins, and on the day of their birth, one of the twins is kidnapped. You start out with the kidnapper, you know who he is, why he's taken this twin, and you also find out that he is a good religious man who, out of love and desperation, has committed this heinous crime. The retail background of that book is Federated coming out of bankruptcy and taking over Macy's and the Broadway Emporium stores. And that is, you mentioned you were reading Unpredictable Webs. This
yes,
is how...
I need to tell you, Darlene, when I first started the book, what I got quickly, and I wasn't sure what to expect, you know, because every author is different, their writing style is different, but very quickly in the book, you have just, and I like the fact that you have the word webs in it because it is so applicable. There are all these tangled webs of interpersonal communication and relationships, you know, professionally and personally, familially, and you find yourself going, holy cow, I can't believe this is going on. It's almost like I'm reading like a soap opera. And I mean that in the best possible way, because it's like something you just don't want to put down, because I can't wait to find out what happens next. And no, Viviana didn't just do this, and here she goes and does it.
Well, Viviana is my power-hungry, manipulative bitch. And she is the woman that readers would like to hate, but they don't, because there's a certain... vulnerability in this woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not mean. She's beautiful. She's intelligent. She's also manipulative and power hungry. She is actually taken after a real character that was, and this I think maybe listeners would be interested in. She was our fashion director at Bullock's Wilshire.
Oh, yes.
And what she wanted more than anything else was to be a vice president. She was director of fashion merchandising and on the management team. There were 9 of us that were on the management team of the 7 Bullock's Wilshire stores. And her personality, obviously the background is totally different. I had given her in there a boutique on Fifth Avenue in New York. She actually has that kind of a boutique in, I'll just say, the Palm Springs area.
Okay, fair enough.
When I was on a book tour with Twisted Webs, I called her and to see if we could have breakfast. And so she said, I read Webs of Power. She said, was I really that bad? But she loved it. And so she said, I want you to come in. She wanted to show me all around. And she actually was the inspiration for what you're reading right now, because what she told me is, for Viviana to be really interesting, you should make her a cougar. Because that is what she has become. And we're sitting in a restaurant the Viviana person is on one side of me and my husband is on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to get a little more information, and I said, well, what was the main appeal? Number one, a hard body.
Mm-hmm.
And then number two was that he was dumb. And that threw me for a second, and then I totally understood that her toy boy was a telephone lineman. Not real bright, delicious eye candy,
mm-hmm.
but there was no competition. He thought everything she did was wonderful. And what I found out in when we were sitting there, I am very careful in building real three-dimensional characters, four-dimensional characters, whatever. I want them to be real people that you can relate to. And at the time that I was there, I was writing my third book, which ends up to be the first in the sequel. What readers prompted that? Readers are very important to me, but I had written Webs of Power and Twisted Webs. Many readers wanted to know more about the life of my characters before they came on the page of the first book.
Okay.
And actually, I don't advertise this a whole bunch, but I do to writers' groups or listeners. I had actually written what is now Webs of Fate. That was actually the first novel I wrote, except I had to do it from a blank screen. But the first novel I wrote was really this book. And so I thought, well, okay, I'll do a prequel. But I had to do it from a blank screen because that was really a learning tool. But I thought,
sure.
Boy, I said, I've got a good plot. I've got the characters. I've got all this. This is going to be a snap. You know, I've already got it there, even though I had to do it from a blank screen. But it was not that easy, because when I wrote that book, I had not written Webs of Power or Webs
mm-hmm.
of Fate.
Mm-hmm.
And there were different things I had to wind in backwards.
Oh,
yeah. And so
yeah.
It was a little more difficult. But it was fun to do, and actually that book was at the time that I was there. Webs of Fate is set in the mid-80s before all of our department stores were called Macy's,
mm-hmm.
and also before our status symbol became How Much Did You Save?
Right.
The background of that book is when we started to see our whole landscape of shopping change. Department stores have gone through a lot of different evolutions. In fact, recently on TV, there was Selfridges. I don't know whether you ever saw that. It was a PBS series.
I did not get that. Yeah.
Yeah. It was, but they were in the 1850s, clear back in the department stores. But as I've looked at retail, in fact, my PR group is so good at, they've sort of empowered me in different ways. They were in terms of when Webs of Power came out, it very much paralleled our economy. It came out in 2008. And with all of the leverage buyouts, the takeovers, and all of the things that had come about, it was, they put me, at first they were saying, well, we'll put you on TV. You've got this background and everything else. Like, what is next in retail? And I'm saying, hey, I've been out of it for a while. And they said, Darlene, you know more than most people do. What I really think, you know, I think all of us know more than we think we do. What we know just seems natural. I mean, we know it, and it's very much in there. But actually, when you go back to when department stores started in the 1850s, it's the same. Everything is different right now, but the main things are department stores have to get the right kind of merchandise that people want to buy.
Mm-hmm.
They need to have enough service enough salespeople to satisfy the needs. And they need to have enough sales to afford the salespeople and bring a profit to their stockholders. It was the same in 1850, as that main principle is the same today.
Sure.
So I had to do a lot of research at the time because I was going on TV and, like, who's on the bubble and what's going on.
Exactly.
And Circuit City had gone down, linens and things had gone down, one after another. And when I was on radio and TV, there, that's what I was talking about. And then it would be, oh, and by the way, she's an author. Or on TV at the very end, they would plug up the books. Now, my TV shows, since I've been doing some sessions with different groups on how to reinvent yourself, they're all about me, which has been really nice.
Well, I want to talk about that in just a second, because I think that's one of the things that I'm most intrigued by, is your ability to say, you know what, it's time for a change. And you might not think about it as a change when you're doing it, but that's exactly what you're doing. I first want to go back, though, to Unpredictable Webs. One of the main characters in the book is Marnie, and she is one of the twins that you write about in your books. Can you tell us a little bit about Unpredictable Webs and the story that unfolds in that particular chapter of the series?
I sure can. I need to just step back a little bit. Marnie is the one that was kidnapped at birth.
I wasn't sure if I could say that or not, so there we go. Okay, cool. I'm glad you said
that. No, that's okay. That wasn't her name. They finally get together when they're 8 years old. And when the girls in Twisted Webs finally get together, I'm not going to tell you how, but when they finally get together, it's kind of cool to be a twin. And everything is great and things, you know, are fabulous when they first get together. But at the opening of Predicted Webs, the twins are almost 16. Callie, the other twin, is very popular, involved in a lot of things. She has memories that Marnie does not have. Marnie was brought into the family when she was 8 years old. And they're at an age when they want their own identity. Marnie had been a only child. And actually, Marnie's mother, the woman that brought up Marnie, did not know that she was raising a kidnapped child. She thought Marnie was the mother of an unwed mother who wanted a better life for her child. That's what she was told and what she believed, and actually her husband's intention until he arrived at the hospital and found that the unwed mother was gone. But when Unpredictable Webs, Marnie's unhappy about a lot of things. And teenagers can kind of get this way, you know, things aren't going right because of whatever. And she gets involved with an online thing, getting in contact with this fellow online. And they decide that they're going to meet once she goes to Chicago. And then I'm not sure how much further I should go in that.
I think that's a good place to stop, because
yes.
There's so much that goes on. Just immediately from page one, and you get your fingers caught into this book, and all they want to do is keep turning the pages. So I think that's a great place to stop for now, because we want people to go buy your book. So if you were listening to the show, whether it's live or in Technicolor, there's the link on the show page to go to Amazon and just click the Unpredictable Webs link. You can buy it and have that on your – is that on Kindle as well, or is that just paperback right now?
All of my books are in paperback, hardback, ebook, whether it's Kindle, Nook, or whatever you have, and also in audiobook. They're
perfect.
In all formats.
Well, let's talk about your audiobooks for just a second. There is a reason why you have your books in the audiobook format right now, isn't that correct?
Well, I love audiobooks.
Well, I do too. It wasn't. Did I read something about one of the schools get wanting to turn
the Braille Institute?
Yes, there we go.
Okay, that kind of got me started. I was the keynote speaker for the Braille Institute, and when they asked me to be their speaker, of course, I wondered where they got me. It came out of the blue, and they were talking with my assistant, and they said, "Oh, and we're going to make that into an audiobook." And it kind of surprised me. We thought, well, don't they need any kind of whatever? And, I mean, we were pleased that they wanted to do it. We were not going to tell them no, that they couldn't do it, but I would think you'd have to have some kind of a release for it. So when I was up there, and I don't think they've actually gotten it into, they're putting it both in audiobook and in Braille.
Wow.
So,
what a cool thing to do.
Yeah, it was. And so when I was talking to the director up there, they under the handicap law, they do not need permission. They just take the book and do it,
nice.
Which is, I think it's great to have that available. And it was really when I was talking to the people, there were about 400 in the audience, they were asking if it would also be in Braille. And that I didn't know, but the director said, yes, it would be.
That's great.
That was sort of my kickstart, and I didn't know when they were going to be doing it. And so we looked into having the audiobook done. And my assistant, Kathy, who you talked to last week,
she's a great writer.
Who is also an award-winning author. She was listening to a lot of different people and kind of picked out some. And we found the narrator that we like. I love audiobooks. My very favorite way to devour a book is to hold a hardback in my hand. And I do that. I always have one at my bedside, but I don't have enough hours in the day to read as much as I'd like to read. So I have been hooked on audiobooks for a long time, and I go through a 3-mile walk each morning, so that's my fuel. And
What do you like to listen to?
I listen to all different kinds of things.
Really?
Yeah, I probably have on my iPod now, I probably have over 100 books because I go through probably, within 2 weeks, I'd go through 3 books.
Wow, okay.
And, you know, writers who don't read really don't have the tools to write. And I don't have enough hours in the day to read as much as I would like. So we looked into that, and it was after Webs of Fate was the first one we had. Webs of Fate was coming out, and I guess it was right after that that we did it, which was really a fun thing for me to do because after you go through, I mean, you go through, you edit and you re-edit and go through all of these things, but once you've gone through the final edit, you never read your own book. You know, you're working on something else. You just don't go back and read your own book. But the process in an audio book is she gave me 15 minutes to see if I liked her, and some funny things were happening in that book. She was terrific. But there's a place where the benevolent dictator, because the benevolent dictator is in Webs of Fate,
mm-hmm.
When he was a man that would speak in slow, precise tones, where, you know, you'd wait for the shoe to drop, he would, you know, just stop at an inappropriate time and you're wanting to wind him up and say, come on. Well, I made the statement that he speaks in slow, measured tones. And when she did his, I thought, oh, my God. I said, Karen, he's the president of an organization. He's not retarded. And she went back because she'd gotten quite a ways with that, because she'd send me a few chapters at a time so that
sure.
I could read them, review them, and, you know, if there was a pronunciation wrong or something else or somebody was out of character. And she said when she went back and listened to that, she said, "You're right, he did sound retarded."
Oh, goodness gracious.
And I think the narrator makes so much difference. I know that I've listened to some of the Janet Ivanovich books.
Sure.
And she has a terrific narrator, this C.J. Critt. She's just terrific. Just personality, this cocky Italian protagonist that she has. But for, I think it was book 8, she got a different narrator. And instead of a cocky Italian, she had a whining Jewish person. And
uh-huh.
I have no negatives on Jewish person, but it was just one of those over the top. I hated the book.
Oh, my gosh.
And there are books that I pick up that the narrator does make that difference.
Yep.
If they're talking in a monotone or something else. But I saw that after that one book, she went back to the C.J. Critt.
Well, we've got about 4 minutes left, and I want to have you talk briefly about your reinvention of Darlene Quinn.
Okay. Well, that's just something that happened. you know, as far as I was on a TV program where I followed an author that wrote a book on how to reinvent yourself,
mm-hmm.
and her key points were like mine, except one I have totally opposite. First, follow your passion. Generally, that's where your skills go. Do a lot of networking. And I think networking is so important because as human beings, we love to help each other. We feel good when we can help each other. And yet so many times, we won't ask for help. We deprive somebody of the giving us the help. And what this author said is, don't tell anybody what your goal is. And my feeling is, tell everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's negative to not tell them. You're saying, I'm going to fail. And a lot of times they say, oh, wow, you should talk to my friend so-and-so. You'd be perfect for that. And
exactly.
I think the networking is extremely important.
Completely agree with you there. Okay, so we could spend another 2 hours talking about reinvention. So we've got the Darlene Quinn series for 2015 to invite her back to talk about that. So as we get ready to wrap this up, where can people see you next? What's your new book about? Any words of wisdom for other writers that are listening in tonight?
Basically, it takes time. As far as if you go to my website, events are there. I'll be at the Southern California Writers Conference in San Diego over President's Day weekend. I have some with panel associations, women clubs, different events. And the book launch for Conflicting Webs will be March 29th. Barnes & Noble in the Marina Pacifica in Long Beach. And advice for other writers is anybody can be an overnight success if you work hard, write the nice book within about 10 years.
Darlene, you are just an absolute treasure. I am so grateful to have met you at the OC Screenwriters Workshop, I think back in September, and I can't wait to finish Unpredictable Webs and get neck deep in all of your other web books that are out there. Everybody else who's listening tonight, if you get a chance, please go and check out Darlene's webpage, check out her blog, buy some books, follow her on Twitter, and do all of the things that a good listener should do, because we want to have Darlene back. Darlene, it's been a huge pleasure. What an honor to have you here on the show tonight.
I had a blast with you.
Yeah, that sums it up. We've had a blast. So with that, everybody, just a real quick reminder, we're going to have musician C.G. Reich on the show with a very early start time on Friday because he's got a gig. And so he's going to spend 2 hours with us from 2 to 4, that's Pacific time, on Friday night dance party. It'll be a Friday afternoon dance party. And for everybody else, we'll see you live tomorrow night. And, Darlene, thank you again. Have a great evening.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Rated G Radio.